greet each and one of you in the name of our risen Lord and Savior. Well, I don't have much theology this morning for you. Felt that we had a healthy dose of that in the Sunday school lesson. I was going to say there's no theology, but that for something, if I have a message and no theology, I'm not sure if I have anything. The message itself maybe will be short. I want to have a history lesson to begin, and then a story. And children can pay attention. And I have some thoughts in the end, at the end, that maybe could be called a message. This message is different. But there's been something that has impressed me through the years. I first read the story when I was a boy. And I'd like to just go through it, and like I said, it begins with a history lesson, and I hate to erase the verse. Behind me here, but I think I'm going to do that. I think the writer can redo it, hopefully. The lesson, the story starts in the 1500s with the Dutch Mennonites. So you have the Mennonites in Holland living here. They experienced persecution in Holland and they moved to Prussia. Quite many of them did. More than 100,000 of them migrated into what is called Prussia today is modern Poland. This happened in the 1500s. And they lived there for about 100 years up until 1763 when Catherine II of Russia invited them to come to live in Russia. And many, many took her up. She offered freedom from military service. She painted a rosy picture of life in Russia. And many, many did that. And they settled there 1763 on through for over 100 years. They had very peaceful times. Starting about 1900, life began to get rough for them. They had it divided into two different colonies, the Molochna colony and the Kortytsa colony. And these two colonies, the Mennonites, were basically self-governing. They had their own police force and all that. It's a very interesting history. I'll take you up to World War II. World War II in Germany. This is right here. Hitler takes control in Germany. He takes his army east to Stalingrad and lays siege to it. As he crosses this area, it's called the Ukraine. This is the area where the Mennonites are living in force. This is where their colonies were established. And this is where they were living. The Mennonites were who? They were Dutch Mennonites, yes, but they had lived in Prussia for many years. They were German, strong German. They kept their German roots. As Hitler and his armies marched across this land, they felt a kinship with the German soldiers. Life had been very difficult. In the 1920s, you had the Russian Civil War between the whites and the reds, and the Mennonites were caught in the middle of that. And the Mennonites were involved, sadly to say. But the progress Hitler was making in laying siege to Stalingrad grew to be very difficult. Winter set in. He had to retreat. As he retreated back across his territory, many Mennonites joined in. Now, I'm not sure some of them joined because they wanted to follow Hitler, this German man. Others followed because they wanted to get out of Russia. They wanted to get back into Europe. 120,000 Mennonites were living in the Ukraine at that time. But 35,000 came back into Germany by the end of the war. So at the end of World War II, you had 35,000 coming back along and living as refugees. Remember, these were now Russians, Russian Mennonites, living in Germany. Well, we know what happened at the end of World War II. You have Germany being divided into four sections. The British took the one section, the French took another section, the US took another section, and this section was Russia. This was at the close of World War II when the Allies divided up Germany. In the Russian zone was the city of Berlin. The city of Berlin was divided into four as well. And so you had Russia controlling one fourth of the city of Berlin. Okay, back to the 35,000 refugees. These 35,000 refugees were sprinkled all throughout these four quarters of Germany, four zones, and in the city of Berlin. 35,000. The MCC was involved. Mennonite Central Committee was very much involved. They were stationed in Akron, Pennsylvania. People, you all know where Akron is. That was the headquarters. But they were involved with what was going on. They rounded up the Mennonites that they could find, and they came up with 12,000. What happened to the 23,000? There's 23,000 Mennonites that basically disappeared, just like that. What happened was, and this is written in the book, The Last Secret, the Last Secret of World War II, but the 23,000 Mennonites were gathered up by Russia, not just in their zone, but in all, even in the free zones, and forcefully took them back, either killed them or took them back to Siberia, to the camps, to the death camps, and just annihilated them. Many Russian Mennonites were trapped in these zones. But like I said, the MCC only got together 12,000. Germany was in shambles at the end of World War II. Many buildings were destroyed and mounds of rubble from bombing. But some of these buildings did remain standing, and the Mennonites found some of these places of shelter and hid there. In fear. They were in fear. They were in great fear because of Stalin. Stalin was the leader of Russia. Stalin was feared because he killed millions. He killed more than Hitler did. Some estimates say anywhere from 15 million to 60 million people died because of Stalin. After Germany was divided into this, you have especially the Mennonites who lived in the Russian zone quickly tried to exit the Russian zone and get into the British or the French or the US, but as they would come to the border, they were caught and sent back to Siberia. Stalin was very careful to catch these people because he wanted the West to, he didn't want the West to see him as he truly was. He was trying to protect his image, and so he didn't want people talking. So as the Mennonites realized what was happening, they stopped trying to flee to the borders, and they just froze, and they found these buildings. This is where our story begins in 1946. One day, this is the story of Peter and Elfriede Dick, and some of you probably know a little bit about this. One day, there was a U.S. military officer, a lieutenant colonel named Stinson, who was driving around in the city of Berlin, in the U.S. zone in the city of Berlin, right here. And he was in, I'm not sure which zone he was in, it doesn't really matter. But he was driving around, and it was dark, and he thought he noticed some lights in the bottom of a building that was supposedly destroyed. So he went in to investigate and found, he called it a rubble hole. He discovered some people there and he talked to them and he realized that they were from Russia. And he said, oh, you want to go home? Oh, I can help you that. I'll take you to the Russian zone. We'll help you to get back to Russia. No, they said, we don't want to go back to Russia. And he said, well, why don't you want to go home? And then there was communication. These people weren't sure what to say. And one of them finally said, maybe the American Mennonites can help us. And he said, what did you say? The Mennonites? What do you know about Mennonites? Lieutenant Colonel Stinson was from Pennsylvania. He knew the Mennonites. Well, he didn't know if all of them were telling the truth, though. He wasn't sure that they were all Mennonites. But he went out of there and got on his telephone and called MCC. I'm not sure about that point. I'm not sure where he called. But there was a connection made to Peter and Elfriede Dick. Peter and Elfriede Dick were husband and wife. They were in their 30s at the time. They had married late. They were not married very long, but they were responsible. They were in Holland responsible for the refugee problem that was happening here at the close of World War II. Somehow the connection was made to Peter, that Peter went to check out this group in this rubble hole that Stinson had found. He got the location and he showed up, and of course another stranger, and Peter's own testimony says as soon as he showed up, the women and children would shrink into a corner and the men would stand front and form a protective guard. They didn't know who this was. But Peter started talking in Plattdeutsch to them, which is the Low German language that they were all familiar with. And he spoke to them and he calmed their fears, and they relaxed and started opening up, and it was a wonderful experience. It was like an angel to them. Here was this Mennonite who understood them, and he was a Russian himself. His name was Peter Dick, or Peter Dyke. It can be pronounced both ways. Just a wonderful experience. Well, Peter went back to Colonel Stinson and told him that they were all Mennonites. And Stinson said, well, would you know? And I think he probably knew all along, but Colonel Stinson told Peter to get them out of there. He said, it's not the U.S.'s problem. While they're there, the U.S. military will protect them, but you get them out of the Russian zone. It was the MCC's job. Well, how is a Mennonite agency supposed to get these refugees out of Berlin to this border where there was freedom? How is the MCC supposed to do that? These were people that Stalin was trying to take back to Russia. In the meantime, Peter asked Stinson for help, Colonel Stinson, for finding better housing. So Peter would go into Stinson's office and say, Stinson, I need another house. And the U.S. military would help them. They would find another abandoned house with the approval, and they would settle them in there. Elfriede did very much in organizing all this, and they had a house. And then Peter went to Stinson and said, I need another house. So he would give another house, and it happened up to 12 times. Finally, and Elfriede was organizing the domestic needs of these refugees. Food was sent from Holland via Dutch ambulances. The Dutch government was concerned about Dutch citizens, refugees of their own city. Holland is over here. So they were sending ambulances across into these zones to bring Dutch citizens back for treatment. So the ambulances were coming across empty. So Peter had the idea, well, bring supplies. So the ambulances would come across bringing food into the Russian zone, into the restricted areas, and then they would pick up their Dutch citizens and take them back. But that's how they got their food into the Russian Mennonites, the refugees. Finally, Stinson had enough. He said it was 12. Peter came in and wanted a 12th house, and Stinson said, no more. Well, in these 12 houses were 1,200
Russian Mennonites. Now what do we do? Where do we go? There's no way forward. The Russians were not going to agree to any proposal other than sending them back to Siberia, sending them back to Russia. They needed to travel 150 miles across the Red Sea to the British zone for deliverance. For 9 months, they struggled and waited, praying for deliverance. During a meeting, about at the eight-month period, during a meeting with the MCC and a top-level U.S. military, they made an agreement. The MCC's responsibility was two things. They were to find a country for these refugees to go. It was not to be in Europe. These refugees were to disappear. They needed to get far away. It was the MCC's job to find a country, and it was the MCC's job to provide transportation to that country. The U.S. military would transport them out of Berlin through the Russian zone. The U.S. military said that we'll take care of that, but you find a country and you find transportation. So they searched for a country, and they searched. They wanted to go to Canada, because a lot of Russian Mennonites went to Canada. Canada was closed. U.S. was closed. Mexico was closed. Country after country said no. I hope I'm painting a picture of the desperation that these people were in, because it was great. Finally, a small country, a small landlocked country in South America said yes, and that was Paraguay. Paraguay said yes. So they had a country. Then they needed to find a ship. So they went to the shipping companies, the shipyards, to the shipping lines, and said, we need a ship. We need an ocean liner. And they tried and tried, and the companies would say, well, don't you realize we just had a war? Half of our ships are at the bottom of the ocean. Finally, the Queen of Holland gave approval to pull a ship out of service to use. It was called the Volendam. The Dutch government charged $375,000 for use of the ship. She was influenced in her decision by the presence of the MCC in her country. And she knew who they were. She knew the work that the Mennonite Central Committee was doing on behalf of the refugees. And she said this. She said, should not the one hand wash the other? And she gave her blessing. She gave him this ship. So they had a ship, and they had a country. So a top secret date and hour was set to put the plan in action to bring these refugees across this 150-mile Red Sea. The ship was very large. It actually had room for 1,000 more, so MCC sent out messages to other regions, to Mennonites who were living in free zones, and said, do you want to go to Paraguay? Do you want to live in Paraguay? And they had no trouble finding another 1,000. So the ship was full with the 1,200 that were coming from Berlin, and 1,000 more or so that were coming up from other zones. But suddenly Peter got a call from Colonel Stinson and said the deal is off. The deal is off. The U.S. military is saying, no, they're not going to do it. Now what? The ship was already in Bremerhaven, Germany, which is, let's say it's up here. The ship was there waiting in the seaport. Ship was waiting. The captain was getting anxious. But Colonel Stinson says the deal is off. Peter said to Stinson, where he was trying to understand, he finally realized that Stinson was helpless, and Stinson was trying to do everything he could. He realized that it was coming from higher up, and he said, and Stinson admitted that it came from General Clay. General Clay was the top military, U.S. military general in that area. So Peter asked to see General Clay, and Stinson laughed at him. He stood up and said, "Look at me. Look at my badges. Look at the decorations that I'm wearing. I can't even get to General Clay always when I want to. And here you are, little Mennonite, and you think you can." Well, Peter, after consulting with his wife, Elfrida, he sat down and penned this letter to General Clay. Quote, "There have been moments in Mennonite history when the future of the group depended on one person. And here are now about 1,200 people, and we look to you, General Clay, to be that person that this day will tip the scales and say yes in their favor and help them to get out of here according to the original agreement." He took that letter to Clay's office, talked to the secretary, and she said, "Well, yeah, you can expect an answer back in about 10 days or 2 weeks. The ship was waiting. The captain was anxious. Let's get moving. In the meantime, the train from this part of Germany was already on its way, carrying the 1,000 or so. What do we do? Well, Peter waited in his office, and about an hour or two, the door opened and Clay said, "You can come in." So Peter presented his letter to Clay. And General Clay took it very seriously. In fact, Clay walked around his desk and stood right next to Peter and looked in his eyes and said, "Are you aware that there may be an incident?" He meant that there may be problems. This is a military situation. There may be shooting. Are you going to take responsibility? Is MCC going to take responsibility if some ladies, women, and children lose their lives? And here was this young Mennonite MCC man. What was he supposed to say to a question like that? How's he supposed to answer that? Am I going to take responsibility for women and children losing their lives? And he said, "No, I can't." Well, General Clay said, "Okay, well, that deal is off. Train can't do it by train." Remember, they were supposed to take these Russian citizens in a train across 150 miles. It was too dangerous. Well, Peter said, "Can we fly them out?" So General Clay called his aides in, and they drew up plans. They looked at the maps, they looked at airports, and they looked at logistics. They said, "No, can't work, can't do it." Meanwhile, like I said, the train was moving up through to Bremerhaven. Well, then they decided they're going to take it through to Washington. What's Washington going to? Maybe Washington can make something happen. So the MCC, so Peter left Clay's office and calls the MCC and alerts them to Washington's involvement. The message came back from Washington: "You have permission to move the Mennonites through the Soviet sector, provided the Russians agree." Oh, that's a lot of help if the Russians agree. Well, let's just all march right up to the border and go across. Another roadblock. Peter had to tell the group there waiting in their rubble holes, waiting in these houses. They weren't in a rubble hole anymore, they were in houses. But he had to go back and tell them that there's not a way. It was a special meeting that they called together, and he left them know. He broke down in tears. He was crying because he had done all he could. And there was responses from the crowd, from the refugees. One man stood up at the back and said, "If it's the Lord's will, I'm ready to go back to Russia. That's where my wife is buried. That's where my children are buried. I'm ready to go back to Siberia." Another lady stood up and said, "I know why we can't get out, because we've sinned." What to do? Peter and Elfriede talked and communicated in private, and they agreed to separate. Elfriede would stay in Berlin with the refugees. Peter would go to the ship. Remember these others. The MCC's responsibility, these people were traveling up through to meet the ship. So Peter went to be with the ones on the ship. Elfriede stayed behind. This is a long story. I'm still not done yet. Try to speed up here. But in Berlin, Elfriede had a prayer meeting with the ones with refugees. They prayed specifically for a miracle, that God would open the Red Sea. And some actually started packing. They started packing their bags. They believed that he would. On the ship, the captain was anxious. He wanted to go. He wanted to leave. They called everyone together up on the deck, and they tried to sing. They tried to pray. They tried to have a service. People were crying. Remember, these were free families. They were in freedom. They were anxious to get reunited with those who were in bond, who were, families were separated. They were looking forward to being reunited. It was a hard thing. Suddenly, while they were gathering at this meeting and trying to sing, trying to pray, suddenly two Americans board the ship and asked for Peter Dyke. Said, there's a telephone message for you. So they get off the ship and went into a jeep a couple thousand yards away, and the two Americans were saying, there's the phone. It's a hotline. It's a hotline. They were all excited for some reason. Peter answers the phone, and there was a lady's voice saying, is the ship still here? And Peter says, yes, the ship's still here. I can see it through the window. And the lady went on to say, if the MCC wants to hold it for a while, your group for Berlin is cleared. You can go. And he said, wait a minute. Can you repeat that to me? And she repeated it. And he said, who is this? And it was a click. Okay, he gets back up to the ship and he's excited and he wants to tell the joyful news and he says to the ship people, how do you send a message? And he said, well, right, you just use this loudspeaker right here. And so he got on the loudspeaker and he said, God is going to do a miracle. The group from Berlin is coming. And Peter's own testimony was that there was a bunch of celebration, and then it got quiet. He said it seemed like suddenly the deck of the ship was like a holy ground as people realized that God just moved. Well, Elfriede was quite a distance away with the people. Peter did not know this, but she had already gotten the message as well. They gave her 1 hour and a half to get 1,200 people packed and ready to go. She did it. She was an organizer, and she got them ready. Peter didn't know this, but he's decided he'd headed to Berlin. It was a long, cold drive. Got to Berlin, and only to discover that the train had already left toward the border. 45 boxcars. Well, they made a stop, and he found out where it was. He raced to the sidling and found the train. Found Stinson. Stinson was there, all happy and joy and jubilant because everything had gone through. They boarded the train, and the train started its journey across this 150 miles, and it went without incident. They got to the border. The train conductor or the train driver stopped with his cow catcher about 3 feet from the line, in the British line. They sat there and waited. Meanwhile, Peter was looking around and he saw other trains sitting there waiting. He saw the Russian agents walking around looking into trains, and they just waited their turn. Sitting ducks. A train full. It was bitterly cold, and there was little stoves in each car, little wood stoves, and had little stove pipes sticking out through openings. It was obvious that there was heat in there. They were sitting ducks. He saw them, they waited their turn. There was a red light in front of them and a crossbar that was down. And the driver of the train. He was a German. He was explaining to Peter how all this works. Peter, of course, knew all this. He said, I know how these things operate. I know when a light turns green, it's time to go. Peter was outside the train. Suddenly, he heard a click, and he saw the board going up. And just like that, the light turned green, and the conductor said, all right, let's go. And so Peter hopped in the train, and, well, they started moving. Well, you have 3 feet from the border. It doesn't take much, and you're across. The whole train got across, all the 45 cars, and he stopped. It was in British territory. They started breaking into song. As one car, the first car started singing, the next car started, took up the chorus, and he started singing, now thank we all our God, with hearts and hands and voices. God gave them a miracle. As far as the explanation for what happened, It's not even really clear how it happened. Somehow, in the negotiation between the Russians and the negotiation between the State Department and the negotiations between MCC, there was a little window of time between communications that green light to go was able to be made. And it was at that time that the message quickly got to the border and the light turned green, and the board was up. One of the men that I did not mention yet, behind the scenes, although he was at that time in MCC, he was probably their top man. He was actually Elfrieda's older brother, C.F. Clausen, Cornelius Clausen. In reflecting on all this, said, God can. Now, he said it in German, Gott kann. God can. And that's the title of my message this morning. That's a long introduction. But I want you to realize that, and we can go back to the Red Sea experience, but we don't need to go back to the Red Sea experience for an example of how God can do something, how God can work. First of all, I want to say that first point is God is the only one who can do it all. God is the only one who can do it all. Mark 10:27, and Jesus looking upon them said, with men it is impossible, but not with God, for with God all things are possible. Whether it is keeping you, dear ones, this morning, whether it is keeping you in the hour of temptation, or whether it's opening this Red Sea for the Israelites, or bringing 1,200 Russian Mennonites across the border into freedom, God can do it all. He can provide for your needs at the moment, right at that needed time, right in the nick of time. His timing is right. God is the only one who can do it all. Number two, just because he can do it does not mean that he will do it. I gave you an example this morning of a time when God did do it, but God does not always do it that way. Sometimes he has reasons and ways that are beyond our human comprehension. Turn to 2 Corinthians 12. This was already alluded to this morning. As always, it's very interesting to see the parallels of how the Spirit moves in our services. It's always an encouragement. But we mentioned these verses in 2 Corinthians 12. Where Paul talked about being caught up in a paradise and hearing unspeakable words. And I guess there was a temptation there to glory and all that. Verse 6 says, for though I would desire to glory, I shall not be a fool, for I will say the truth, but now I forbear, lest any man should think of me above that which he seeth me to be, or that he heareth of me. And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. And for this thing I besought the Lord thrice that it might depart from me. But he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. There, most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. God can. But in this situation, God gave him a thorn. God gave him a messenger of Satan. This doesn't seem right. These are not nice things. But God puts us into these situations to humble us. In verse 7, lest I should be exalted above measure, there was given me these things. Just because he can doesn't mean that he will. It does sometimes. There's a higher purpose. And God allows these difficulties in for a reason. You do not understand it now, but someday you will understand it, why these things have happened. But God can. Point number 3. Sometimes it seems he sends hard things our way to wait for us to reach out to him. It's like some of you have very young children and they need to learn to walk. And so you stand there with them and you hold them and then you let go. Often there's two people, one that's letting go and another one is just a couple feet away, just hands out waiting. And so this child takes a few wobbly steps. And the other one is there just waiting to catch. You know, it's that way with our Heavenly Father. He's his arms are out to us and he's wanting us to take those steps. He will do it. He can do it. Well, I just said he will not always. Sometimes he lets us fall a little bit. Sometimes he sends things that make it difficult. But all the time his arm is out there, just like a parent with their ready to catch that young child. Maybe it's a teenager driving a car for the first time. Whatever the situation is. How does he feel when we reject him and try to do it ourselves and then fall flat? And we all know that happens sometimes too. Or when we reach out to something else and go down a wrong track away from him, how does that make him feel as his arms are reaching out to us and yet we just turn our focus off another way and go off this side? Reach out to something else. Jesus said in Matthew 23:37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and you would not. God longs to have his people reach out to him because he's reaching out to us. He can. God can. God knows he can. We know God can. Let's reach out to him as he's reaching out to us. Point number 4. How do we know God can? How do we know God can? Number 1, because he did. Because he did in the past, in our own lives. I think all of us can look back to times in our past where God did. God can because he did. Also, God can because he said he would. And I guess I won't turn to these references, but Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. 2 Peter 2:9, the Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. The context here is of Lot. If you remember the story of Lot, Lot found himself in a city surrounded by wickedness, but God knew how to deliver him out. And God did in that situation. We know that there was, of the people that came out of that city, there was a choice. Some chose to follow, one did not. Psalm 34:17, the righteous cry and the Lord heareth and delivereth them out of all their troubles. Verse 19 says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth them out of them all. So we know that God can because he said he would. The final point is not I can. Okay, the message is God can. Number five, it's not I can. The big I gets us into trouble. It does many times. A child says many times, you parents, you hear this over and over, I can do it, I can do it. I can do it myself. I want to do it myself. And that's a worthy goal. But so often we say that to God. I want to do it. And how often does that get us into trouble? You know, we sing the song, it's a very good song, Striving Onward, Pressing Forward. Very good song. But this is where it kind of jibes with the Sunday school lesson this morning. But so often, striving onward and pressing forward in our own strength gets us into trouble. Somehow, the attitude is, yeah, we're striving onward, but somehow we're doing it all in our own strength. And God is left to be off in a side somewhere. We have this, I'll call it Mennonite up. It's not just Mennonite. Maybe you can blame the Germans, I don't know. But if you want to get something accomplished, just work really hard and get it done. That's the way we tend to operate. Something needs to be done in our lives, in our house, in our shop, in our farm. We just get it done. Just crash. Everything else needs to fall by the wayside. We just get it done. In our own strength. That's how we operate. But the problem is we don't always get it accomplished. None of us can. We're human. And then we crash. We didn't make it, we crash. Why? Well, where was God in this whole picture? Why wasn't I reaching out to him instead of just, well, yes, I know, we can't just sit there and do nothing. If we sit there and do nothing, well, of course nothing will get done. But sometimes I look in my own experience and I feel like instead of reaching out to God, I'm just trying to crash through life in my own strength. But this morning, God can, and he wants to. Too often we're in a situation where we say, well, we understand that if we have big problems, we would give them to God. But we have just little ones, and so we think we can do it ourselves and let God out of the picture. I think that's how it is sometimes. You know, if we were in a situation where these 1,200 refugees were, yeah, we probably realize that it's all up to God. But the problem is, in our lives, we're not faced with big situations like that. We're faced with little ones, but we think we can just make it through. But God can this morning, and he wants us to let him do it. It's okay to let the vacuuming to another day if a child needs some mothering. It's okay. Please. It's okay to let the mulching do another day if a neighbor needs help. It's okay to have a dirty car if you need to spend some time with your son. It's okay to struggle. It's okay if you can't reach around because God can. I don't know what you're all facing right now or what we'll face in the future. But we need a mixture of courage, fortitude, and God. God's not going to do it all for us if we sit back and do nothing. But neither will it work if we sit there and we can somehow accomplish it all because we can't. God can. Sometimes we feel when we go about these things on our own strength, sometimes we feel like we're winning, but it's all in our own strength. And without God, these wins are only fleeting. And not lasting. Philippians 2:13 says, "For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure." So there's a will that comes from us, and there's a purpose of heart that needs to come from us, but it's God that works in you to do that. Let's not forget that. So when called to go through a Red Sea experience or just the daily struggle of life, don't go alone. God can. God wants to. Let him. Let's kneel for prayer.